Do I need help?
Well, at least we'll be addicted to it.
Good morning. I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Human Services on this Monday, May 23rd, 2011. Welcome, colleagues. Today, as you can see, is a pretty simple day, but an important day. We're going to have an informational hearing on long-term care in the Ombudsman Program right here in the state of Oregon. And we have a special guest with us, the State Ombudsman, Mary Yeager. And Mary, I'd like you to come up and share with us your presentation. We're looking forward to it.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There we go.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Mary Yeager, for the record. I'm the Oregon State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and I'm here to answer questions and share a little bit of information about this terrific program. So last week, you were emailed a report that I could read to you, or we could go right into questions and answers. You tell me what works best for your time schedule and your preferences.
Well, we've given you almost an hour, right?
So an overview of the presentation before questions, just sort of get the wheels going, would be
okay.
Great.
So I titled this presentation, The Silver Tsunami. And I've opened with several pages of just basic Oregon senior demographics, with the idea that unless we know where the old people are and what the numbers are that are coming, how do we begin to prepare our long-term care facilities? And even though most Oregonians over the age of 65 still live at home, our program is charged with oversight for 43,000 licensed long-term care beds. So that's nursing homes, residential homes, adult foster care, and a wide variety of memory care and other related resources for people with dementia. What we are not charged with is the kind of facility that deals with developmentally disabled or children. So we are solely 65 and above licensed long-term care over a variety of levels of care. A little bit about the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. We are mandated in Oregon, as in the other 49 states and territories, by the Older Americans Act. So the Older Americans Act in the late 60s provided for this amazing, largely volunteer advocacy program because of the horrendous situations that all of the United States was finding in long-term care. That term, warehousing the elderly, was really the push that sent our U.S. Congress into almost 100% agreement to put in this provision for an ombudsman program in every state. So in Oregon, this is the way it works. We have 10 staff members and now over 200 volunteers. So we've divided Oregon up into territories. Most of our staff live in or near Salem, and from Salem work with a variety of counties across Oregon. And in each of the counties and in each of the areas, we have anywhere from 3 to 55 volunteers.
There are some, if I may,
please,
Mr. Chair, thank you. There are some counties, as I remember, that have no volunteers. Is that correct?
Representative Dumais and the rest of the committee, yes, there are counties that have no volunteers, particularly in the east, in eastern Oregon, and Klamath County, Curry County, we're struggling. On the positive side, most of our volunteers are where most of the facilities are, which is the metro area. But for example, in eastern Oregon, we have about 12 volunteers who literally cover, if you divided Oregon down through Bend, literally that entire section of eastern Oregon are covered by about 12 volunteers who, I'm always proud to say, never flinch at driving 80 miles one direction to follow up on a complaint and are often willing to visit foster homes on the way back to their homes.
Follow up?
Please.
So tell us, Klamath County is having problems. Curry has no volunteers, is that correct?
That's correct.
Any other counties?
And Malheur.
Malheur? Okay, thank you. All right, I'm sorry to interrupt your...
No, Wallala has one. On the other hand, Wallala has a very small percentage of facilities, so... Oh, thank you.
It gets very sensitive.
Oh, sorry.
Very much like co-chair.
And I'm so quiet, so I could probably sit in the back of the room and talk.
Great.
So a little bit of about our volunteers. They go through a pretty intensive recruiting and screening to be able to be a volunteer, and then go through another 40 hours of classroom training before they're actually certified. They take an exam. They take this work very, very seriously. But the thing that's so amazing is most of our volunteers themselves are over 65, many of whom have already had successful careers, some two, three, and four careers, teachers, CEOs, lawyers, doctors, nurses. We have a chef, a professional chef. We have IT professionals. We have a CPA. Just a wide variety of backgrounds and experiences that have brought them to our program. And as you know, Oregon has an amazing amount of volunteer opportunities for people who would like to give back to their communities. So we feel privileged that so many people have chosen to help seniors in facilities and people with disabilities in facilities who otherwise would have no one advocating for them. So
while you're on that point, I just wanted to mention, while we're in session and over here, and we have legislators from east of the mountains, if this would be helpful, we can talk offline too, using them to help recruit volunteers that may meet your standards. I'd be happy to be an advocate for that.
Oh, thank you so much.
In my caucus, there's probably not a lot in the Representative Harker's caucus from that side of the mountains, but
coming though.
But we can talk about that, because it seems to me that might be one source if in fact we need more folks in those counties, as co-chairs pointed out.
Well, and co-chairs and committee, we have found that the absolute best recruiting mechanism has been volunteer to volunteer and in small groups, you know, certainly faith communities, community centers. We've had a little bit of media coverage in different parts of the state, and that always brings the best out in people who who call and say, gosh, I could see myself doing that. Or I had a traumatic experience with an older person and had nowhere else to turn. I wish I'd known about your program. So this poster I have in front of my seat here, by Oregon statute, every licensed facility is required to have that poster. And where you see that 800 number, That is available to the public if we have a volunteer assigned to that building. The volunteer's name and home number will be there. And our volunteers take calls, you know, 24/7 to respond to residents' questions or concerns or those of family members. We also often get calls from other agencies. Hi, I was in this building. Something didn't seem right. Would you send a volunteer over? So the way our system works is, if there is a volunteer available, first response is by the volunteer. If the volunteer either can't be there or they're not assigned, another volunteer is asked to go try to do a backup at that particular place. And if there's no backup volunteer, we send a staff member. So back to my demographics. As you look at what's coming in Oregon, we really need to start thinking about the next biennium in the next 5 years and the next 10 years. In Oregon, we have over 520,000 people over the age of 65. And right now, that's 13.4% of our total statewide population. Currently, one in every 7.4, so I guess we could say seven-ish, Oregonian is over the age of 65. And our Oregon population over the age of 65 is currently growing much faster than any other part of our population. So while we're concerned about children, we're concerned about youth, I just want to remind this committee and the rest of our wonderful Oregonians who are listening to this that we cannot forget the people over 65, particularly as we're thinking about a new 10-year budgeting cycle. By 2030, Ready? Over 20% of Oregon's population will be over 65. One in five Oregonians will be over the age of 65. I heard a fascinating statistic last week that not only in Oregon, but nationwide, 20% of people who are in their 90s have a child who's a senior citizen. So if you think about people you know who are in their 60s, who have a living parent in their 90s, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. 20% of people in their 90s have a child who's a senior citizen. So oftentimes, that child or children may be the only family member available to offer resource or advocacy, and in many cases, the residents we visit have no one. We are the only people, other than regulators and medical care providers, who come into where they live to ask them questions about how's it going, or to respond to a very specific question that they have called into our 800 number.
Another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, I remember, I might not have been from you, but I remember the last time we had a hearing about this program. As I recall, someone said that 60% of the people in long-term care facilities never get a visitor. Is that still correct?
I've seen...
Don't lean forward. Oh, there you go.
You're going to have to send me to remedial speaking class.
You're fine.
I'll sit back.
Okay.
Representative Tomei and committee members, I've seen that statistic anywhere from 55 to 75%. So I think it depends on what type of facility people are talking about. But if you think about the typical foster home, five people, usually not on a main road, usually in a part of a community that is a little bit off the beaten path, what are the odds of visitors coming to see someone unless they happen to know that the person's there?
I just think, Mr. Chair, that that is an astounding statistic, and it's very frightening to me, frankly, because, I mean, I think this is great to have this poster in a facility, but I can imagine somebody who's elderly, who feels very vulnerable, reluctant to make that phone call. They are dependent on this person.
They don't have another connection.
Right.
Yeah.
The more I think about this, I mean, we've heard testimony over the years, certainly about children and disabled folks who are in vulnerable positions, but it seems to me that this is a population that we should be taking a lot more attention to. This is really frightening to me. This is one of the reasons that I'd hoped we could have this hearing, and I'm not sure where we go with this, and maybe Mary can help us with this, but it seems to me that this is a population that we need to be spending some energy and attention on.
I agree. Thank you.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Nope, no problem. In your document, I then go through...
Just one more.
Oh, yes, sir.
Herker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Related question. One reason that you cited that folks might not get visitors is the location of these homes or facilities are sometimes out of the way. Is that true primarily for financial reasons, that the cost of locating these facilities outside of a town, property's cheaper, taxes are cheaper, et cetera? Or are there other reasons that I haven't thought of this Monday morning?
Co-chairs and Representative Harker, I would agree that those are the primary reasons. If you're going to open a foster home, you're not going to open it on expensive real estate right in the center of town. It tends to be more financially feasible to have a home that's a little more off the beaten path. The downside of that is, you know, when are you walking down the street and randomly stop by your local foster home? Unless you know someone who is there.
Sure.
Or unless you have a purpose to perhaps view that home for maybe a potential admission by a relative or family member, you would have no reason to go in there. To follow up with that, most of us really don't think about long-term care or the need to even find a facility for a relative or friend until that crisis is upon us. And then it's a scramble that happens in 48 hours.
There aren't any follow-up?
Please.
Thanks. There aren't zoning restrictions that prohibit these facilities from locating in, say, residential or mixed residential areas, are that you know of? It sounds like it's almost entirely a financially based decision.
Co-chairs and Representative Harker, I believe it's a combination. I believe there does have to be some sort of zoning because at the same time it's a care facility, it is also a business. But again, to the point of visitors, we are oftentimes the only visitor other than providers or required visitors to that particular building, which is not to say other people wouldn't notice things as well, but to the point of the need for actual visitors for many elderly and disabled folks living in long-term care, we really are one of the few outside groups that actually has a chance to go in.
And if I could respond to that, thank you. A friend of mine lives up in the Alameda area in Portland, and I just am going to her home. I see two homes for foster homes, mm-hmm. So I think that may not be a huge issue. I think that that every city has to zone the acceptance of a foster home. I think, am I correct in that?
Yes, you are correct. I just don't know what the specific zoning requirements are. And again, you know, if you are on your way to visit your friend, I mean, what are the odds of dropping into
None.
Your local foster home or nursing home?
None.
Zero.
And I'm sure my friend doesn't drop in, even though one is just two houses away from her. She would have no reason to go in. And I think this program assigns people to visit there. And that's great, only as I look back down on your materials, we ranked 48th in the country in the number of beds per deputy. The deputy is the hired people, and then you recruit volunteers to work with the deputy. But do you see what I mean? Even though it might be in the neighborhood mm-hmm. where it might be two houses from you, if you didn't know someone there, you probably wouldn't make the attempt to visit there.
Especially if you didn't speak Romanian.
Well, this is a Romanian band, but they speak English.
But many of the caregivers in
Multnomah
County are
right.
Romanian.
And they are in this neighborhood also. But, of course, they speak English because their clients are English-speaking. But, yeah, it's still an alarming statistic. And I interrupted again.
Oh, no problem. Back to the intent of the Older Americans Act being ombudsman for people who live in nursing homes, it's often astounding for Oregonians to hear that we only have 140 nursing homes for the entire state of Oregon. And to compare us to a state like Ohio, where there are over 900 nursing homes, it gives you a sense of the scope and Oregon's 30 years of moving people out of nursing homes into more community-based settings. And frankly, most of our seniors still live at home. So if you look on the second page of my presentation, we have 140 nursing homes with an average bed size of 85. We have 209 assisted living facilities with an average of 67 beds, 235 residential care facilities with an average of 38 beds, and ready, 1,690 foster homes, which for this document I call them non-relative foster homes, and they have a typical average of 4.7 beds. So the distinction between those two types of foster homes is that under Oregon regulations, if I were able to get approved to move an older relative into my own home, that would be called a relative foster placement, where it's just one caregiver and one resident. Those are the family foster care. We do not have jurisdiction over those facilities. We only deal with the provider who has 5 beds and, as you see, an average of about 4.7 census. So moving along, the distribution of our beds, it really varies widely depending where you are in the state. Statewide, we have 173 licensed long-term care beds ready for every 1,000 people over the age of 75. 7 counties have more than 200 beds for every 1,000 persons over the age of 75, and those are Gilliam, Hood River, Multnomah, Union, Wasco, and Yamhill. 16 counties have fewer than 150 beds for every 1,000 people over the age of 75. In declining order, those are Columbia, Harney, Jackson, Deschutes, Benton, Marion, Polk, Crook, Douglas, Lincoln, Wallowa, Wheeler, Klamath, Curry, Lake, and Tillamook. So the point is, we do have quite a large number of beds across Oregon, but they are distributed in a way that actually mirrors our aging population. So back to our program. Again, every state has a long-term care ombudsman and a long-term care ombudsman agency. Our agency has 10.75 FTEs. We basically have no budget increase for the coming biennium, although we're grateful to have that budget and plan to use it as wisely as possible. Again, the reason we are such a wonderful investment for the state of Oregon is that for every staff member we have on board, they work with anywhere from 20 to 40 volunteers. And those volunteers put in 10 to 15 hours a week.
Mary, could I back up for a second?
Yes, sir.
You mentioned Ohio. I have reason to be excited about the state of Ohio. But I was born there.
Oh.
How does our tsunami fit nationally by population? I don't know if you got the specific figures, but just even generally, where are we?
Well, co-chairs and committee, I believe Oregon is one of the 13, what they call aging states, where we have an unusual proportion of people over the age of 65 and even a greater amount over 75 and 85. So while Ohio has, in numbers, a much larger population than Oregon, Ohio did not make the moves that the state of Oregon did 30 years ago to start moving people who don't need to be in nursing homes out into other kind of levels of care. So today in Oregon, the people who are living in nursing homes have an average length of stay of 90 days or less in nursing homes, and then are moved to other levels of care or, if possible, home. Because again, most seniors live at home in Oregon.
So our commitment to long-term care is one issue. The other, I was recalling the same hearing I think you were, mm-hmm. was a joint hearing with the Senate, and I was amazed of the influx, particularly of Californians, but retirees who are attracted to Oregon, which a state like Ohio probably doesn't have. That's another major factor is older, new Oregonians.
Mr. Chair, when you look at the population pyramid, the proportion over 65, the major factor is whether you have an influx or an outflow of people under 65. Like South Dakota is a state with a very large proportion over 65, and it's not because all the retirees want to go to South Dakota because of the nice climate. It's that the young people leave because of it.
Jobs.
Until recently, actually, that's changed quite a bit in the last few years. But Oregon's influx of under 35 has also been pretty impressive over the last few years. Portland's number three city in the country in bringing people under 35. And so some of this population is related not to the proportion over 65, but the number over 65. And I think that number has been growing pretty quickly. Not with retirees, but with aging.
Yeah.
I mean, someday you'll get over 65, and then you'll be sorry.
That's not relevant to this whole discussion.
Go ahead. But we have an ombudsman for you. You should meet one. So back to our amazing volunteers. All in, we need more volunteers, and we need more staff to work with the volunteers. There is a point at which a staff member can only work with so many volunteers. It's like class size. Yes, you can add a few more students, and then suddenly it's unmanageable. But I'm very proud of our staff and our volunteers for literally taking on more and more as we get more well-known, both in facilities and by people who actually want to come and volunteer with us. And we also benefit from the services of what we call administrative volunteers. So we actually have a volunteer chief financial officer. We have amazing volunteer IT services, a retired CEO and software developer, who is not only one of the ombudsman volunteers visiting with the seniors and answering their concerns, but works with our office and has actually completely automated our report process, which is both for the state of Oregon and for the Administration on Aging. To receive our federal dollars, we need to do some pretty extensive data reporting once a year to AOA, which requires mercurial detail that otherwise, without these volunteers, we would not be able to complete those forms in a timely way. So,
do we know what AOA is, Mr. Chair?
Oh, thank you.
I apologize.
It's a very strict rule we keep here.
I know, and I swore I was not going to start taking on acronyms in this role. The Administration on Aging.
Thank
you. So that is the agency in charge of all things senior, particularly the Older Americans Act. And the reason I reference that is because several of the titles of the Older Americans Act actually bring money to the state of Oregon, not only for the not only for the ombudsman program, but for Meals on Wheels and Meals for Seniors.
Mr. Chair, could we follow up on that?
Please.
So I'd like to know what proportion of the funding for this program comes from the federal government and what proportion comes from the Oregon?
So co-chairs and committee, going forward, starting with the new biennium, about 30% of our budget will come from the feds, specifically through the Older Americans Act Administration on Aging money, and the other 70% will come from Oregon general funds.
Follow up?
Please.
And what is the amount of the general fund that comes to this program?
I should be able to tell you. Our overall budget is $1.4 million, so I believe it's $600,000.
Oh,
they'll correct
that's,
me on the,
that's fine. That's
on the back side of the record.
Enough. Thank you.
And the Administration on, is it OA, what'd you say?
AOA.
AOA. The Administration on Aging, largely located in Washington, D.C., I assume. Is there a regional office, Seattle? Do you get assistance locally?
So, co-chairs and committee, yes. There is a Region 10 office in Seattle. And last year I was able to visit with the Region 10 folks. They actually came to our office and did a little bit of looking around on about our program and were just thrilled with the data we were able to share with them, particularly the number of hours that our volunteers put in. Compared to the earlier statistic that we are 48th in out of 50 states and territories in numbers of paid staff to actual beds supervised in Oregon. And then another wonderful statistic, our volunteers were able to contribute just last year $685,000 of volunteer time. And that's computed at, there's a national average, it's about $20 an hour for a volunteer's time. And if that were to turn into actual funds, that would be about $685,000 contributed to Oregonians who otherwise would have no other advocates. Mm-hmm. Pretty impressive. So, just a little bit about the cases. Each of our volunteers opens about 4.5 cases every quarter. And in 2010, we opened about 570 cases every quarter, so over 2,300 a year. A case means something different than an actual visit. So if I were to go into a facility as a volunteer, uncover someone who has a particular problem that I could manage, I would take care of that myself. If I open a case, there are a number of items that need follow-up. There's been cold food. The medication that the resident has been getting has been coming at odd times. It doesn't seem to look like the medications they took last month. Allegations of poor care at night. Allegations of any variety of 183 kinds of complaints we take. But the point is, there's an ability to follow up on those with data and documentation by our volunteers or by our staff. I think it's important for this committee to know that 85% of the complaints that our volunteers and staff follow up on are taken care of in-house. So we do not refer those to any other agency. That remaining 15% most likely is referred by one of our volunteers or staff to the Adult Protective Services. So an example, I go to visit a facility, perhaps because they've called us, or perhaps because I'm there on my 4 or 5 hours, I'm visiting with people during the week to see how things are going, and I notice that Mrs. Smith has bruises. What do I do with that information? Our volunteers are trained very carefully not to be abuse investigators. It really confuses the role with Adult Protective Services and people who have the real ability to do, you know, almost forensic follow-up and investigation. So our volunteers make a phone call to whatever their local Adult Protective Services office is. Mrs. Smith has suspected bruises, you know, just wanted you to know, and it is on, then on their shoulders to follow up on those allegations. We've had a little bit of difficulty getting feedback from the agency, either to our volunteer or to the actual complainant. So you can imagine if you've called our office because your mother has unexplained bruises, and you know that we are the advocacy agency, you can imagine you would actually like some feedback. Did somebody investigate it? What happened? Is my mother okay? Is there something going on with other residents? So I've started, with the assistance of the agency, we've started really trying to meet together and look at some of the specific data around those cases that we have referred to them that takes quite a bit of time to get some information back, not only for our office and for our data that we need to send to AOA, most importantly, for that resident or that resident's family. So some more attention as the new biennium starts to really getting better, much better information back from us, and most importantly, to the residents or families themselves, is pretty important.
Mary, I want to stop you for a second, and I don't want to minimize the success because it's impressive in terms of all the things you're checking on and the fact the 85% these issues are resolved. However, we all know that we're all pretty focused on the alarming rate of reported or alleged abuse against seniors, particularly physical sexual violence. This committee sent a what is now a task force, no, it is now a work group bill to dovetail with the team that you serve on. We serve on together because of the session. I haven't been a very good attender, and you actually are doing the work, and I appreciate it. But I want to talk a little bit about some of those issues around the abuse. I understand what you're saying, that this is not something we're training our staff and volunteers to do, to report certainly, but not necessarily to start any kind of investigation. But nonetheless, I think you've said a couple of things at the Adult Protective Service team meetings about a registry, an abuse registry. Can you talk a little bit about that and how we can make that a more effective tool, especially consumer-friendly? Sorry for this long question, but I'm particularly thinking of your comment earlier that many of us don't focus on this issue until suddenly we're faced with a parent who needs it, 48 hours go by, and boom, you've made a decision and they're in. And these reports of abuse, the information of abuse, is either not available or difficult to find. That's a lot there, but I'd appreciate your comments.
Co-chairs and committee, I'll take your seven-layered question, if I can remember it. I think if we stood back and said, if we had to find a placement for an older relative in the next 48 hours, and they weren't, you know, in Oregon or in the state that you lived in, how would you go about finding that? I mean, you can rely on hospital discharge planners to a tiny extent, and other than that, unless you know where to call, you're sort of at the mercy of the internet, or actually knowing how to call Department of Human Services in the state of Oregon. We know that DHS is working on their website. If you took the time to look at some other states, Texas, Ohio that I mentioned earlier, Illinois, consumers have a much easier path to find out about the facility that you're going to move mom or auntie into. I mean, it's easier, you keep hearing this reference, and I'll use it again, but it is easier to find a hotel in another city and find out about the hotel services, pictures on the internet, you know, ways to find out what complaints have been against that hotel than it is to find out about long-term care. And here we are in the information age, and here we are in this, in one of the most connected cities in the United States. Everyone's got an iPhone. Maybe not everyone, but certainly in the metro area, there is much better access to sort of an electronic way to find out what is really going on behind that. So I think one of the first things that this committee could help with and help encourage members both in the House and Senate is to really push for clear information for consumers. Tell us about that. Give us a way to find out about that home's history, their quality history, and there are required state and federal surveys. If you're a nursing home, for example, receiving Medicare, if you're a foster home, you still have an investigation. Let's open that up to the public. We talk about transparency and government. Government is spending an awful lot on long-term care in this state, and I think the consumers and taxpayers really need a much better way to find out how that money is being spent and what kind of care is being provided. So there's a jillion national experts who talk about things like that, but I just think at a really basic level, wouldn't you like to know? And wouldn't you like to know that if something horrible happened in that facility, whatever level of care that was, that there would be transparency and disclosure about what that was and what the facility was going to do to correct it. So to follow up, the point about an abuse registry, I know the department is working very diligently right now to try to post names of whatever the criteria is, just serial offenders or people who have reached some sort of certain threshold. I think it needs to go well beyond that. And our entire ability to look at someone's background depends on what county you live in. If you work in Multnomah County, but you want to be a care provider in Clackamas County, you're required to go through two sets of fingerprints. If you're a teacher by profession during the school year, but you want to be a care provider during the summer, you have to go through another set of fingerprints. I mean, whoever figures out how to capture all the different levels of fingerprints or background check or social check or whatever method each agency uses is going to, you know, really do an amazing performance, serve an amazing bit of good for the state of Oregon and for our seniors, because it really just depends. I think I lost track of your question.
Well, everybody probably did.
That's very helpful. I'm grateful, again, that you're on that team. And for committee members, I'll get right to you, Representative. For committee members, this is, with my co-chair's support, this is something I think really important, and the focus, not the only thing, but the focus of that task force that we sent over. If it gets through to the Senate, we'll have the benefit of your work and the work of others that are on that. It supposedly ends about the end of June, and then our task force hopefully would begin after that. What I'm hoping will come out of that, and I'm glad for anybody that wants to participate in this, is that we in the interim will have this as one of our priorities for this committee and come forward with some suggestions, some specific ones along the lines you're talking about, whether it's the fingerprinting issue, the transparency issue, the website, that we can move forward and discuss possible legislative and policy remedies for the February session. Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that actually goes to a piece of legislation that I dropped to open up the conversation was for a public website for that. But I want to go back a little earlier. You were discussing medications and things like that. Very dear friends of mine just moved. We actually call him Uncle Orville.
Aww.
We moved him from one home to another because they would medicate him so he wouldn't get up and walk around. And they were basically knocking him out during the days. And I'm just wondering, do we see a lot of that kind of abuse, or is that being documented? Because there's a lot of stuff you can do with meds to seniors, and he wasn't somebody who needed it, but he likes to get up and go visit, and that's just the way he is. Now we have him with some friends, and we know the people personally where he went to, but we had to pull him out of the home because they were doing that to him.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, may I ask a question back? Do you know what level of care home that was? Was that a foster home or a residential or assisted living?
I think there are multiple levels, this particular one. And then he went to an assisted living. He was in an assisted living part, I believe.
So the way our volunteers, had our volunteer come across that information, they would have called that information to Adult Protective Services. That's a very clear concern that would fall under Adult Protective Services, who would likely then call what they call corrective action or the survey division. So someone would go out and investigate from the agency what happened there, and there could be a fine tied to that behavior, or they would send out other regulatory bodies on and on and on. But that is not something we would follow up on. We would refer that immediately.
Okay. Now, if I may follow up,
please.
Is this something that's more common than we know about with using medication to over-medicate our seniors or, you know, knock them out so they don't have to deal with them? You know, it's like, I don't like Uncle Orville getting up and walking around and me having to worry about finding him to get him back to his room and things like that when he just wants to go out and socialize. Is this something that's common in the homes that you've seen? Or
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, I personally have tried to go to a different facility at least once or twice a week since I started now 19 months ago. And even though I actually have, it's what do they call it, on hold, or I haven't paid to keep up my license, but I'm a trained Oregon nursing home administrator. I do have an Oregon license that, what do they call that? It's not in suspension, but you know, it's inactive. That's the word I'm looking for. Hello, be a senior. Can't think of the word. I would say that in the 20 years since I have worked in facilities, what used to be called a nursing home, the level of care of somebody in that place, that then would only have been in a nursing home. In Oregon, we are taking care of people who used to be in nursing homes, in foster homes, and in residential and in assisted living. I mean, it is the days of it being someone who's able to take care of themselves and dress and bathe and kind of watch their own medications are slipping by. The people who live now in those levels of care are very needy, very, very needy of watching and protection. 20 years ago, there was concerns about restraint use. You know, actual physical restraints. Then it morphed to chemical restraints, meaning your points or medications. My sense is that those concerns are happening less in actual nursing homes, licensed nursing homes, and being shifted to other levels of care because the regulations are so different. So even though the level of care is what a nursing home used to be, the level of reimbursement is not that of a nursing home. The level of oversight is not that of a nursing home. But yet, people who are living in those places have got numerous, numerous medical concerns as well as psychological, perhaps mental health, and maybe even are heading down the road in some type of dementia.
Mary, do you want to have a summary of your presentation? Is there something, a last word, unless there are other questions from the committee? Oh, Representative, good to see you.
Full time.
Okay. I'm sorry, it's my mistake.
Well, co-chairs and committee members, thank you for letting us talk a little bit about this amazing volunteer program. And my request of you would be to keep us on your radar, both here in the Capitol and back in your districts, and please pass along two things. One, if people would like to be volunteers, there's a way they can help. And secondly, if you know people who have a concern, or you have a concern yourself, please call us, and we will send a volunteer or a staff member to follow up on it. And then I guess finally to say, this is one of the good programs. It's in part, it's sad that it's needed, but one of the good things about it is Oregonians have helped each other for a very, very long time. It just looks a little different than it did on the wagon trail. Mm-hmm. And now it's in the neighborhood and following up on someone that you knew from work or church or school. So it's really a program to be that we all need to be proud of, that so many seniors who could be doing other things are taking the time to help people who have no other voice. So thank you for giving us this time today, and I look forward to hearing from you if you need help. Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, I have a question, then I'd like to make a statement to maybe to you. So, Mary, you seem to say that without more employees, without more deputies, it would be hard for you to have more volunteers that they would supervise. Is that true?
That's correct.
So my hope was that we might be able to encourage legislators, especially in the counties where there are so few volunteers, to recruit volunteers. If we were to do that, could you handle that? If I'm looking especially at Klamath County, Curry, Malheur, and Wallawa. If we were to encourage other legislators in those counties to recruit volunteers, would you be able to handle that?
Co-chairs and Representative Tomei, we would be able to handle the volunteers in those counties where we actually have almost a surplus is in Multnomah County.
Right, right.
We've just had this amazing recruitment effort
right.
there. But
right.
absolutely,
so, Mr.
we would
Chair,
love them.
If you remember, you had a hearing some months ago about people in the communities yes. who were volunteers. And it seems to me that I hope there is some way that we can join in that effort so we can find more volunteers, especially in these more sparsely populated counties, because I'm fearful for the people in these situations if there are no visitors. I mean, I'm hearing you, Representative Widener, talk about a situation that you're familiar with, that because you're there, you have seen this person. I'm worried, and I'm not. Mother-in-law had been, we'd placed her in a series of foster homes. They were wonderful. I had no complaints. They were fantastic. And I'm assuming most foster homes are wonderful. But it does worry me that there are places that people might be going that aren't wonderful, that they're having trouble in. And I think that's one of our responsibilities, is to help people in situations where they might be very vulnerable.
Several good points, and on your point about volunteers, I'm especially interested in communicating with our colleagues, particularly in those counties, while we're still in session. And let's talk about ways we can do that,
yes.
either individually or in our caucuses.
Right.
I would love to activate that network, plus the nonprofit network you
right.
And funnel some good names, particularly in those counties, to you all.
And I would think a lot of the faith community, if they knew that there was this need, that many of them could respond to this.
I agree.
Do you have flyers or anything, brochures or anything that we might pass along to people in these communities?
About volunteering?
Right in front of you are some information. We passed out some this morning. I brought a few extra, and then we have many at the office we can give you.
But specifically, we'd be interested in something appropriate for a volunteer.
Right.
To say, yeah.
Yes, I actually have a job description I could have
yeah.
brought, but I didn't.
So we can get
and
those.
Flyers. So
we'll look forward
I will
to
get them
up.
To you.
Good.
And
thank you
I would
so
suggest,
much.
Too, that we follow up in the interim, that we have an, and maybe, Mary, you could bring at the next meeting people who are actually volunteers.
Fantastic.
To talk about what they're seeing, and especially out of Multnomah County. I mean, if, yeah. Let's find some people from the more rural counties and tell us about their experiences. You're talking about them driving long ways to visit people. Let's learn about what those situations are.
Be delighted to.
I would be interested in doing that as long as I'm chairing. Okay. Any other questions or comments for Mary? Mary, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'll close this informational hearing and look forward to the next one. And colleagues, just one other comment about other issues, particularly kids in foster care. This is Foster Care Month, and Representative Thompson, many of you probably already know this. We're going to have a duffel bag drive, and they'll be in each caucus. So we're encouraging members, and we'll announce this on the floor today, to bring used or new duffel bags. This is a specific need, as you all well know. Of kids that are moving around, they don't have the luggage to get from one to the other. So if duffel bags for kids are sort of the best kind of a vehicle for that. So we're going to do that, and I'll announce it on the floor, but I wanted this committee to know that we're going to do that. Okay? Anything else for the good of our committee? If not, I will adjourn the House Committee on Human Services.
Good evening.